I remember a few years ago being on a committee choosing some prize winners for innovation or some such recognition. There was a new system in front of us with grids, numbers out of 10 in about 12 categories, crossover elimination processes, all in all the same kind of chart you imagine the Pentagon using to invade Iraq in 2003. Now, I happen to know who should have won the main prize. It was obvious. Malcolm Gladwell wrote all about this in Blink. You just know. But the process didn't allow any of that. We ground through the chart system methodically. Hours passed. My winner wasn't even in the shortlist. A list of the usual suspects was signed off. My guy later went on to win 3 national awards. I quietly resigned from the committee. So much for the gossip about decision making. Now the theory. Tim Van Gelder is Principal Fellow in Philosophy at the University of Melbourne.
A few years ago, I asked a group of 50 or so senior military officers to recall the weightiest decision they'd made as officers in the past year. Military officers are professionals with thorough training in decision making. In the Army, for example, they're well versed in the military appreciation process, Army's official method for making operational decisions. I asked the officers, in making that decision, did you use any official, prescribed, or formal methodology or tool? Over half indicated that they hadn't. How then did you go about it? I asked. Discussion revealed that more often than not, officers went through an informal, somewhat haphazard process of pondering options and exploring the pros and cons. They would consult with trusted colleagues, weigh things up, and even sleep on it. The behaviour of these officers, in sidestepping the methods in which they'd been trained, is consistent with what happens more widely, particularly in business. There are standard, widely accepted, normative decision-making methods. These methods are found in textbooks, are taught at business schools, are promoted by consulting firms, and can be Googled in just a few moments. But for the most part, when people make decisions, they don't use these methods, even when the decision may be quite important. How can this be? After all, decision-making is one of the most critical of all human activities. Our health, wealth, and happiness depend on making good choices. So why do we so routinely ignore the officially prescribed methods? Now, many people, it's true, simply don't know the proper way to make decisions. Having never been educated in the theory or trained in the practice of decision-making, they muddle through as best they can. But we can't blame ignorance alone, because as we saw with the military officers, official methods are often avoided even by those who have had good training. Plausibly, the ignorant masses generally wouldn't use good decision methods even if they had been introduced to them. Perhaps then it's just laziness. Elaborate, rigorous decision methods can involve a lot of tedious work. But while people often are lazy, often they're not, and given what may be at stake, you'd think they'd be highly motivated to put in a bit of extra effort. No, there's something else going on here, something much more interesting. The problem isn't with the people making decisions, it's with the official methods. There's a deep mismatch between the gospel of the decision experts and the challenges usually faced by the congregation. To see this, we need to look a bit more closely at the official methods. The canonical textbook approach, at its simplest, says that you should first, canvass all the relevant options. Second, specify the criteria for choosing among options. Third, provide a numerical weight for each criterion, indicating how important it is. Fourth, rate every option against every criterion. Fifth, multiply the ratings by the weights. And sixth, add up the results. Then, to make the decision, you simply take the option with the best score. The basic idea is straightforward and very plausible. Of course, there are numerous variations on the basic model, sometimes becoming quite complex and requiring dedicated software. But all such methods share a common approach. Reduce the decision problem to a systematic set of assignments, run some kind of calculation or algorithm over those assignments, and read off the answer. There certainly are times when these sorts of analytical techniques are just what's needed. They wouldn't have their canonical status if they weren't at least sometimes useful. But they aren't the be-all and end-all for decision-making. They're only part of the story. So what's wrong? Why do these methods not fit so many decision challenges? First, and most obviously, in interesting real-world problems, not every consideration can be reduced to a number. Suppose, like the young man in an essay by Jean-Paul Sartre, I'm wondering whether to go and fight against the Nazis with the Free French Forces, or stay to care for my mother, who would be otherwise wholly alone. To neglect my mother is obviously wrong. But how wrong? What score does it get on the filial duty criterion? At some fundamental level, breaking the problem down like this seems obtuse, perhaps even obscene. Second, even in cases where it might make sense to assign ratings, the ratings can be matters for debate. A massive fiscal stimulus should, among other things, promote employment. A particular stimulus package is claimed to be very good on this criterion. But is it really? Experts could reasonably disagree, and extended disputation might ensue. Often, most of the work involved in decision-making is at this level of supporting argument. But the canonical decision frameworks don't help at all with this. Third, the problem may be too wicked to be shoehorned into any pre-structured decision framework. So-called wicked problems, think Mideast peace or climate change or a divorce settlement, have a cluster of properties making them very hard to tame through any given formal structure, set of rules, or complex calculation. A famous anecdote from decision theorist Percy Diaconis nicely illustrates the futility of textbook techniques. He said, "Some years ago, I was trying to decide whether or not to move to Harvard from Stanford. I had bored my friends silly with endless discussion. Finally, one of them said, 'You're one of our leading decision theorists. Maybe you should make a list of the costs and benefits and try to roughly calculate your expected utility.' Without thinking, I blurted out, 'Come on, Sandy, this is serious.'" Like the military officers described earlier, what people actually do when dealing with these decision challenges is fall back on general purpose, informal deliberation. Deliberation is careful consideration of the options and related issues in terms of the relevant arguments and evidence. When we deliberate, we don't assign numbers and run algorithms. Rather, we canvass qualitative arguments which point in one direction or another. We clarify issues. We gather detailed information. We countenance objections and perhaps rebut them. We often do all this in conversation with others, though we can also do it on our own, imagining how the arguments play out. When people making difficult decisions rely on deliberation, they're not necessarily being delinquent. In fact, they will often be wisely, or at least rightly, using a method that's far more appropriate than the ones recommended by the high priests of decision theory. The trouble is that deliberative decision-making is still a very problematic business. Decisions go wrong all the time. Textbook decision methods were developed, in part, because it was widely recognized that our default or habitual methods are very unreliable. Those textbook methods may not be the answer, but there's still an urgent need to improve decision-making. How might this be done? One recent approach is called decision mapping. To map a decision is to lay out the options and the arguments in a special kind of diagram, similar to a mind map or a flowchart. Decision mapping has two major virtues. First, in making the thinking behind and around a decision visible, it allows us to better exploit the massive processing power of our brain's visual systems. We know, in general, that people can handle complex information more effectively when it can be viewed. Decision mapping just applies this insight to decision making. Second, decision mapping gently imposes some discipline on the decision making process. There are rules and guidelines for mapping. There is right and wrong, or at least better and worse. Decision mapping is semi-formal, tightening up the thinking without trying to confine it within the straitjacket of some particular formal method. How might decision mapping be used in a real context? Corporate boards are one place where important decisions must be made on a regular basis. These decisions are often made deliberatively, i.e. by canvassing and weighing up the arguments. And all too often, these decisions are made badly. Not just in the sense that, with hindsight, we can see that the wrong choice was made, but also in the sense that the thinking at the time was manifestly ill-informed, sloppy, disorganised, incomplete, or biased. A fairly straightforward change to board practice can improve deliberations and thereby decision hit rate. Simply require that management present, alongside their standard board reports, a decision map displaying the major alternatives and the lines of argument and evidence supporting one path over the others. Board members will then be able to quickly see exactly what the case is, and will be better positioned to determine its strengths and weaknesses. When the decision is made, they can have more confidence in the thinking. And a decision map is an archivable record, cleanly and concisely recording the logic behind the decision. Much of the benefit will be obtained even before the decision goes to board. In preparing the decision map, the management team will be forced to articulate the logic of their case with an unusual degree of clarity and rigor. This will allow them to identify and correct problems early on, avoiding potential criticism of their work or even rejection of their recommendation. Decision mapping is a new activity, but it's closely related to argument mapping, the visual display of complex reasoning or argumentation. Argument mapping has been around for a few hundred years, but it has really only taken off in the past decade. This is largely because we now have the kind of tools we need to quickly and easily create high-quality maps, personal computers, color printers, and dedicated software. We have these tools, in part, due to the genius and efforts of one of the pioneers of the information revolution, engineer Douglas Engelbart. As a young man back in the late 1950s, Engelbart wondered how in his career he might best contribute to human progress and quality of life. He decided that the critical problem was the fact that we're not smart enough. That is, the intellectual challenges we face increasingly exceed our brain's cognitive capacities. The solution, Engelbart thought, was to develop tools to magnify our biologically endowed intelligence. Engelbart went on to develop a range of technologies, such as the computer mouse and hyperlinking, which are so pervasive today. Way back in 1962, while I was busy being born, Engelbart was writing a landmark manifesto entitled Augmenting Human Intelligence. He there proposed, among other things, a computer system in which ideas could be displayed on screen and linked according to their logical relationships. Interacting with these diagrams would assist knowledge workers to think far more effectively about complex problems than if they were using raw brain power or traditional tools such as books and meetings. Contemporary decision and argument mapping systems are Engelbart's vision being realized on a technological foundation he himself partly created. We are finally at a point where such tools can actually help us with our thinking challenges, ranging from the hyper-complex, such as what to do about climate change or the global financial crisis, to the merely difficult, such as critical decisions in our businesses or personal lives. It's a good thing that these tools have arrived on the scene, because we're going to need all the help we can get.
You can say that again. I wonder which system, if any, President Obama uses. Tim Van Gelder is Principal Fellow in Philosophy at the University of Melbourne. Next week, something rather different. A letter in verse for Easter from what seems to be the Earth itself. I'm Robin Williams.